Well, when we did last speak, you were at the Toronto International Film Festival, and we spoke about Mrs. Harris.
Yeah.
And then we talked about your music for the film, but we really didn't get into your background as a composer. So what is your musical background?
What is my musical background? Genetically? let's speak genetically first. My dad wanted to be a concert pianist, and he was a pretty good player. And then he backed out when he was in college and went to be an architect. But
right.
So he kept playing, you know, around the house. He played a lot. And so I think at a very early age I was exposed to a lot of music and a lot of different styles, from Cole Porter to classical to, this seemed to be his, Prokofiev and Cole Porter were kind of where he hung his hat.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there was, and then I started singing a lot as a child, and I sang in the choir. We lived in Washington, D.C., and I sang at the National Cathedral. And in the summers, the opera companies would come through on the East Coast, and they would hire children's choirs. And first one I worked with was the Paris Opera Company, and I sang Otello in the children's choir,
mm-hmm,
at the Kennedy Center under Sir George Schulte. And then I sang at Wolf Trap and with the Metropolitan Opera, and we did Hansel and Gretel. And then the next summer, my voice changed, and that was the end of opera for me. So I had 2 big years of opera. After that, I fell in love with jazz, and in particular, the playing of Joe Pass, and
mm-hmm,
became obsessed with bebop and jazz, and that persisted all the way to this day. But it was very much what I focused on in college at the University of Southern California, and then Manhattan School of Music. After I left Manhattan School of Music, I went to work for a famous vibraphonist named Mike Mineri, who played with Buddy Rich and Billie Holiday and the famous jazz group Steps Ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael owned a synclavier, and I learned to be its babysitter. It was unruly and difficult to control. And, you know, the synclavier was the first big digital music workstation that cost about $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took care of a crazy computer for about 3 years and learned an enormous amount about the technology, and that's where I got into working to picture and scoring and into synthesis. After that, I found myself working with Ryuichi Sakamoto on a miniseries as his synthesis and orchestrator. It was called Wild Palms, and Oliver Stone produced it. Right after that, I decided that film music was what I wanted to do, and I was 24, I think, at the time. And so I made my plan to escape New York. And about 2 years later, I ended up in L.A.
Mm-hmm. So from there, you've done your share of action films, some drama, some comedy. What is the hardest to you, the genre of film to compose for?
Well, they're hard in different ways. None of it actually feels hard to me because I enjoy it a lot. The only times I find myself having to push myself to enjoy it is if I do similar movies back to back, because you kind of expressed that, and then you have to sort of rev yourself up.
Right.
So it is nice, and I've been very fortunate to get to switch around a lot. There's different challenges in each area. I would say on Prize Winner of Defiance, Ohio, a very intimate, gentle drama, the challenge is getting in touch and very honestly and clearly expressing emotions without overdoing a scene, or being very gentle to be respectful of the drama and not create a manipulative score, but create one which has an honest effect on people.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a very sort of cerebral challenge. In a big action film or a horror film, it's sort of stamina. It can be sort of like running a marathon where you have to write 95 minutes of music, and it has to accelerate and keep the tension and keep the drive and shape the film through sound.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the challenge in that area. Comedy tends to be an intellectual challenge in that you're there for the sole purpose of supporting the joke. And how does that joke, how is that joke best nurtured? How do you procure it out of the film? And comedy tends to be something which is a little doesn't have as much endurance as drama and action. And comedies tend to do best in the country they're made,
mm-hmm,
because they tend to be cultural,
right,
and they tend not to be funny years down the road. They're not as funny because what we think is funny changes. What we think is sad tends to stay the same.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've also done a fair amount of music for TV as well. What do you find the major difference between scoring for TV as opposed to film?
Well, most of the TV work I've done, with exception of I've done some episodes of King of the Hill for Mike Judge and a little series work, I've never really had a successful series. I've worked on two.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the work I've done on TV has been TV films. And for me, there's really no difference. I approach it the same. There's usually, you have to be more economical and the schedule's tighter. But other than that, I try to just approach it in the same way. Take a film like James Dean, where I sort of had to remind myself that it was a television film. Because, you know, working with a director like Mark Rydell, you just make a film.
Right.
The same would hold true, let me think of some others. The other film I did with Mark, Crime of the Century. And so they tend to sort of feel, you know, you approach them the same way.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you mentioned, you did compose music for King of the Hill, and you also did some music for Enterprise. And
I did two episodes of Enterprise. That was a blast. That was really fun. That was hard, you know. You have 10 days to write about 35 minutes. It's like a little film.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a smaller orchestra, but you have to keep it sounding big, and you have a lot of music to write in a very short period of time.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there a specific sound to the let's say Enterprise, for example?
I mean, was there one?
No, I mean, well, okay.
Past tense, it's gone.
Was there one?
There's no more Star Trek on TV.
I know, that's terrible.
They're gone. Yes, there absolutely was.
Does, I guess, the Paramount executives say it has to sound like Star Trek Enterprise?
Well, it was one of the things that puzzled me about hiring a guest composer, and then sort of, you know, I know Brian Tyler did some, I did some. And if you're going to hire guest composers, well, and then put them into a mold, it didn't make a whole lot of sense. But I think I got to, there was some place, the second one I did, I tried to sort of break out of that probably farther than people were ready for,
mm-hmm.
and was sort of reined in to the sound of the show. But I think if you look at what Brian Tyler did and what I did, I think that you can hear the individual in there. But certainly there's this maybe sort of epic tone with the horns, the patty sound of these sort of noble space warriors that is the sound of the film, of the show. I think that was created in large part, perpetuated by Bruce Broughton, and so many other guys have done the show for a long period of time.
Okay. Well, since we last spoke, you've done quite a few other projects, including a documentary about Walmart.
Yeah.
How did you get involved with that?
Well, that was just a really quick little labor of love that I got involved with. G. Mark Roswell, the music supervisor, came to me and was talking about it, and I was politically infuriated with seeing a supposed American company that doesn't help its employees out and take care of them the way they should,
mm-hmm.
With things like healthcare and many other issues. You know, going to China and producing rakes at a rate that, at a price that can never sustain a capitalist society. I mean, I think their practices are profoundly un-American. So that's why I got involved, is a sense of patriotism.
Well, now, when we spoke last as well, we touched very briefly on your score to The Woods. So what can you tell me about your musical approach to that particular movie?
Well, I think the biggest question about The Woods is, where is it?
Yeah.
There was an article in the LA Times that it's like the film Coffee and Cigarettes. It's sort of become an orphan, this film. It's a wonderful, twisted little picture.
Mm-hmm.
I hope it sees the light of day. I think it's sort of stuck in between. It fell through the cracks when MGM was sold to Sony.
Mm-hmm. Because all it seems to have is this the release date, 2006.
It keeps moving ahead. Every
exactly.
time we get to it, it just sort of leaps farther ahead. I think it'll eventually make itself known. That was an interesting film because it's set in the 1960s. Did you see Lucky McGee's first film, May? I got to tell you, if there's one weird film you see this year, rent May.
Okay.
It's unbelievable, and that's why I wanted to do The Woods. Is Lucky has a very twisted sense of humor,
mm-hmm.
very, very dark humor and strange imagery that he's able to produce. I created a film that sounds like it may have been written in the 1960s as you're in the opening of the film, and it slowly deteriorates into just sonic mayhem. as things get progressively weirder and farther out.
Okay. Well, now, what can you tell me about Black Irish?
Black Irish is a beautiful little drama that I'm currently finishing. It's going to be a very different score for me. I think the score is going to sound like little instrumental songs.
Really?
In fact, I'll be very pleased if people walk out of it and say, oh, there was no score. Because it's just, I'm writing little tunes. It's a drama. There's not a lot of music, but it plays a very simple and subtle and crucial role, I think, in this picture. It's a very beautiful little film, a little festival film.